So, because I spend a lot of time with classic computers, especially talking about them, there's an assumption, which I appreciate very, very much, that I'm some sort of global expert, both in the present and the past, as to all 8-bit computers, that somehow I'm able to juggle every platform and variation that was ever out there. And I'm just sad to say it's not true. I used certain computers during my youth. I use only a small amount now. And there are a few perfectly great platforms that just escaped my grasp. And probably the most major one of all was the Commodore 64. Just never used it. It wasn't a part of my childhood. But this is the month that the Internet Archive has begun the in-browser emulation of the Commodore 64. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Dan Boyd, Jeff Atwood, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who are both giving me encouragement to keep these episodes going and helping me get out of debt. So this hasn't been announced to the general public yet, but we are now supporting the Commodore 64 in the Emularity, the emulation in-browser system that lives on the Internet Archive. I'm in the process of ingesting tens of thousands of Commodore 64 floppies and making them run in individual items, doing screenshots, and all of the things that we do whenever we add a new platform. In fact, it might be worth it to go over a little bit about what exactly happens when a new platform joins the Internet Archive these days, because nobody else is doing it like this, and maybe at the very least I can serve as some sort of warning to never begin. In case you haven't been watching all of this, and I totally forgive you for it, the Internet Archive achieves emulation in the browser using a number of tools created by other third parties. The most vital one is Emscripten, a environment for transferring code into JavaScript and WebAssembly. It's created by Alon Zakai over at the Mozilla Foundation, and it is a wonder. It enables a person to take a program that would otherwise only run natively on a desktop and turn it into something that will run in a browser. And then we take Emscripten and aim it at another code base, which could be one of a variety of emulators out there, the most prominent one being MAME, which was the first one that we made work with this, and frankly is really the best one because it's been built from the ground up to be the most future-proof, understood, and educational. We ended up getting the vast majority of platforms up through it, and when you go to the archive and you use something in the browser, it's probably MAME on the other side. That's certainly the case for arcade machines, most of the home computers, all of the handheld systems. It's definitely MAME back there. But in a few cases, it hasn't worked out with MAME. Not through any of their fault. They are only required to make their system run faster than a native desktop needs it. Anything over 150% speed capability, frankly, is not something you need to shoot for. When it works on the desktop, it works. It doesn't have to run at 1,000% or 10,000%. So everywhere MAME's been doing work, they've been focusing on accuracy, making it so that the emulator is as accurate as possible, so that way there isn't any question later of what these now-gone systems used to do and how they would properly react to the software. In the browser environment, when we are transferring things through JavaScript and WebAssembly, there's a speed hit, a pretty major one, actually. And if the MAME system is not running at a few 100%, it's just not going to run fast in any browser anywhere. you already need a pretty beefy machine and a very modern browser to have this emulation and browser work, and it just won't function at the speed that you need if it isn't already optimized far beyond what it needs to be. So anywhere we've had any problems, or where the MAME emulator isn't quite doing accurate emulation, we've gone to third parties. It's only happened a handful of times. We've used it for DOS, the Amiga, old school Macintosh, and now the Commodore 64. In the case of the Commodore 64, we are running an updated version of something called Vice.js. Vice.js was created by a fellow whose name I think is pronounced Richard Janasek, although he has never gotten back to me, so I'm not quite positive. And around 5 years ago, Richard took the Vice emulator, itself an excellent Commodore 64 emulator, and he used Emscripten and ported it to JavaScript. It's a pretty slick job, in my opinion. It's just a few patches applied both to the emulator and to Emscripten itself, and the resulting JavaScript emulator is smooth as silk. It's just beautiful. The reason we hadn't used it up to this point was just very simply, nobody had given it the time. One of the not-so-secret secrets about working with the emularity and all of this browser stuff is that it really burns people out. We've gone through about 5 people, and they've all had to sit there in the trenches and just take it day after day, week after week, trying to make this system work. It is not a comfortable system. Imagine trying to put a V8 engine into a different car that runs on a different measurement system and somehow have it all function, even though you had to machine half of the connectors yourself, and you start to get an idea of what it's like on the code side. I mean, Emscripten does an amazing job, but you still have to modify the emulator to make it work in a way that Emscripten knows what steps to take. I've highlighted some of the people over the years who have done it, and they sit around in the development channel we have on IRC like a bunch of wrecked veterans, able to lend a hand or give some ideas. But the interest in doing weeks on work that's required, well, you have to get new blood. And we were lucky. Out of nowhere, we got new blood. His name is SGO. He was on my Discord, which you are all invited to if you want access, and he happened to mention that he thought it would be neat to port this Vice over to the emularity. Now, there were 2 factors involved. First of all, the Vice emulator, Vice.js, was based off a 5-year-old version of an emulator called Vice, which is a top quality Commodore 64 emulator done by some very fanatical Finns who have been working on it in all the years since. The version of Vice that Vice.js was based off of is Vice 2.4, and we are now up to 3.2. But SGO took that original one, the Vice.js, and he made it work in the emularity. He made the changes to the code of the emularity loader, and it was just a matter of DB48X, who currently maintains the emularity, making a few suggestions and then slamming it in. And suddenly, the Internet Archive had Vice in the browser. I say that Vice is top-notch. I really can't understate what happens when you focus on one platform only. Vice is an engineering marvel in all of the years that it's been worked on by this group. There are functions for all sorts of Commodore 64 hardware. For example, and I could give many, the heart of a Commodore 64 is the SID chip, which is a sound chip that is beloved by many. And in fact, there have even been aftermarket solutions where people have purchased or taken old SID chips and put them on cards that sit inside of machines, desktop machines, and allow you to use the sound on that chip if you call it, and the Vice emulator will notice all the different third-party cards that have SID chips in them and use that SID chip for all of the sound generation instead of emulating that sound chip itself. That is a level of dedication you don't see in code all that often. In fact, it's got variant sound emulators for the SID chip, competing ones, different approaches that you can call from the command line. Naturally, it emulates all different aspects of the Commodore 64 that will be very obvious to people who've used them, things like warp load so that it loads much faster than the original, or being able to plug in joysticks or alternate controllers or emulations of alternate controllers, and all sorts of configurations. You're able to make a Commodore 64 of your dreams, or at least the dreams of the program, and then execute things using that made-up Commodore 64. It's an incredibly powerful machine to use if you know what you're doing. Pulling it back, I don't know what I'm doing. My only memory of a Commodore 64 in anything before my 20s is the time I was visiting my neighbors, the Scollins, and down in their basement rec room while the kids were playing around, I noticed there was this little console with a keyboard connected to the television, and I didn't understand what it was, but it was a Commodore 64. And I had a Commodore PET, and I had an IBM PC, but I'd never seen this weird color version of a Commodore PET, which seemed to be, in many ways, like a sort of toy. I thought that the reduced columns were weird compared to the 80 columns I had on my PC, and I played around with it and very quickly got freaked out by all the different ways that it required me to use the keyboard to get anything done. And I did some basic tests in it, you know, just made a loop and, you know, futzed around with it during the hour or so I was over at the Scollins, but that was it. It just didn't grab me. It wasn't for me. But then again, I was 13. I really didn't have any connection to this machine in any meaningful way until my 20s, when my love of the demo scene, the European creation of computer-based time art, pulled me in with all of the tricks and music and work that they were doing on the Commodore 64. I can't imagine, much of my audience doesn't know this story, but the Commodore 64 is the most sold computer model of all time, because from its first introduction until it was finally decommissioned and not sold any longer around 1993, it was never changed. They made the exact same model, they sold it, and just sold that same model year after year after year. So there are millions and millions of them, and they have no variants whatsoever. Hence, the most sold computer of all time. In Europe, this computer was the dominant one, probably primarily because of its good distribution, but also because it was fundamentally inexpensive. It was a computer that you could buy for a few $100s when computers like the Apple and the IBM could go into the thousands, and as a result, it became the computer that you got for Christmas, and you gave it to the kids. It wasn't a fight between parents and children to use it. It was for the kids, and for a generation of kids, especially in Europe, it became the closest, most awesome technical companion that rewarded you for figuring out tricks and memory mapping and assembly language. And as the demo scene rose up, the Commodore 64 dominated. So we're talking a pretty major aspect of computer history that just utterly passed me by until it became something I used in my adulthood. And for people who wanted to keep the experience of the programs made for the Commodore 64, emulators were going to be the way to go. The Vice emulator comes out of the same fertile ground that the Commodore 64 demo hacking comes out of. So it is a very deep, very rich creation of the Commodore 64's environment. And the power of these browser emulators is that we are not doing anything from scratch. We take the best work out there, make it work inside of the browser, and then we enjoy all of the improvements that come over time. So once we got the Vice emulator working in the Emularity, I turned to SGO, who was naturally proud of what he'd done, and said, "This is wonderful, but is there any chance you could do it with the modern version of Vice, the one that's 5 years older?" And bless him, he took a shot at it. And that's when SGO joined the other people who had walked into the box full of the bloodstains and the bones and said, "Maybe I've got a shot in here." And for the past few weeks, SGO has been doing a hero's job of making Vice work with version 3.2 in the browser. To do it, he had to take every improvement and suggestion from the original port of Vice and figure out exactly how the new version made it work. And it turned out to be very different in places, and there were many features that were added, and it was just the kind of nightmare that everybody else in that channel could totally understand. But, and this is important, he's done it. We now have Vice 3.2 running in the browser at the Internet Archive. This brings up the next interesting problem, which is, what now? There's a lot of work that has been done to keep the Commodore 64 history. I mean, I'm very proud of what other people, both affiliated with me and not affiliated with me, have done with various other parts of computer history, but nothing touches the amount of work that has been done on the Commodore 64 side. People have not just imaged disks by the hundreds of thousands, I'm not kidding, hundreds of thousands, but they've done unbelievable work in tracing lineage of programmers and demo scenes and parties and finding lots of videotapes and recordings of people discussing the work they're doing. And even going to the point of scanning in all of the old computer magazines for the Commodore 64 and creating lots of cross-reference databases enabling you to know that this particular Commodore 64 game appeared on these pages in these issues of these magazines in the 1980s. Nobody else is coming close to that in any of the other platforms. It is a level of self-chronicling I just take my hat off to. And it was a pleasure to take one of these large collections of Commodore 64 discs and start to figure out, how am I going to put this on the archive in a way that doesn't overwhelm and make it impossible to look through? I mean, I can't go ahead and put up all of the tens of thousands of discs. So here was my thinking. I ended up choosing a variety of the old school Emulation Center collections that had roughly 178,000 Commodore 64 disk images. And it had lots of variation. So I focused on one file format, D64. There's other ones, but that one had a pretty good cross-section of what people would expect to be on a Commodore 64 library. Then I made another decision, again, making sure not to remove anything of the original large collections, just building what we're going to build this library from. And I made it so that only one version of a given disk was the one we were going to use. I'll explain that. The way that a lot of times people would image these disks, they would have a program that everyone knew. Let's go with something like Whizball or Jumpman or Little Computer People. And these titles would have variations, Variation 1, Variation 2, Variation 3, where the arrangement of the data was different, or the people who had hacked it were different, or the name it was cracked under was different. And in some cases, there were 5 variations, 10 variations, 30 variations. There were 80 variations. The winner was Little Computer People, a fun little simulator written by David Crane, which had over 230 variations chronicled in this collection I was using. Well, I went ahead and I made it one of each, and that knocked things down to about 40,000. Then I made a decision to focus on the games and the demos and then a few other representative programs, but not to go for applications right now, not to go for business software, just because I wanted to have it stop somewhere for now. And this brought things down to about 35,000. Of the 35,000, they have all been uploaded to the archive, and I have already been running my screenshotter on it. This thing boots up each given disk, watches it for a couple minutes, takes lots of snapshots, gets rid of the duplicates, and then chooses the quote-unquote best one, and then puts it up. And in doing so, it's doing one disk every 2 minutes so that I don't have to. And on top of that, I've written scripts to then analyze whether or not the disk booted at all. It looks at the colors on the screen and the arrangement of the text, and then it decides, oh, this actually never boots, because it turns out some of the disks never auto-boot. And for the purposes of this library, I'm letting things auto-boot for now. So I'd say a few thousand have already been placed off to the side so that the only ones up in the collection are ones that auto-boot into a program. This itself brings up yet another question, which is, what's the end audience going to do with this? Are they going to walk into this nightmare scenario of tens of thousands of Commodore 64 programs that are emulated? And if they don't know what are the best ones, which ones will impress them or give them a nostalgic kick, what are they going to do? And so I've been working on something called a showcase. And this is just a lightly curated set of the quote-unquote classics that I have been kind of pulling up, ones that are renowned in reviews or which have beautiful graphics in them, and just putting them together so that there'll probably, by the end, be about 100 pretty good ones to enjoy that a person who just wants to get the idea and move on can visit. I'll be announcing all of this from the stage on October 3rd at the annual Internet Archive Bash in San Francisco, which you are also all invited to every year. I'm usually on the stage announcing things, at the very least announcing things related to software, and this Commodore 64 emulation will make its official debut then. And until then, we're back here in the backstage. SGO and DB48X and BI, we are all working on making things run smoother, make sense, and be able to function on as wide a variety of machines as possible. The thing works, I'd say, pretty well. We have run some pretty neat programs on it, and when the sound comes through, and when the Commodore 64 sound was hacked properly, the music is just beautiful. When the strains of Bubble Bobble go by, or Whizball, you are, I think, transported to a kind of weird space sonically. It's more than just chiptune. It's kind of this otherworldly place that a Moog synthesizer might take you. It's really beautiful. I mean, people were able to squeeze out some of the most beautiful graphics and sound out of this platform. And while I'm sad to say that my childhood didn't have any part of the Commodore 64, my 20s and my 30s most certainly did. The demo scene for the Commodore 64 is breathtaking. And as our sensibilities towards glitch and chiptunes has grown and become part of us, these Commodore 64 demos have grown to encompass that new aesthetic. And I think it's really a joy to experience, whether you do it with a real Commodore 64 or an emulator. What's the world going to do when it finds out that we're emulating the Commodore 64? Are we going to see more articles where people talk about why the Commodore 64 was important? Have we burnt out people on yet another platform at the archive, just going to go by with a yawn? Are people going to focus where the emulator doesn't work as well on the browser for them as they would like? Are they going to be blisteringly angry at the heinous war crime of not having a specific title up? I don't know. I've seen all of this before. What I do know is that, like all the other times, as I've been in that room, on that IRC channel, watching as somebody beats their head against the code and encouraging them to take another step, to try another solution, that when we finally get it working, when we open our browser to a specific URL, and in there is a computer that has been around for a long time, unaware of where it is now, instantly accessible, and making the noise and the graphics and the art that was put into these with such love, it's a feeling I don't get anywhere else. This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Sam Johnston, Adam Green, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who are helping me get out of debt. If you want to join the Patreon, it's patreon.com/textfiles. This is the month just before I looked to pay my taxes for 2017. I applied for an extension just because it was too much too quick. And now my accountant and I are figuring out how much of a hit I took from all of the podcast money of 2017. Obviously, 2018 is going to be exciting too, but I'm not afraid. I'm not in any way fearful. We're going to come up with a number. The number will probably be four figures, and then I will either pay it or I will pay it in installments. There's not going to be a situation where I don't pay it, or that I can't pay it. That's an incredibly great feeling. My relationship to taxes has been so up and down over the years that it's really nice to know that I can focus on paying for my car, for my medical bills, for my electricity and my cable, and not worry that a few bucks here or there that I didn't know about would put me into a tailspin. It's liberating. It's delightful. And I thank you for it so much.